You're listening to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. This episode is a live session from day 5 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023, and it's called The Story of Russia, Orlando Figgis and Simon Sebag Montefiore in conversation with Luke Harding.
So Orlando's terrific book is going to be at the sort of mothership of our discussion now. And I just wanted to kind of start with a provocative question. I mean, in the introduction, Orlando quotes George Orwell from 1984, the famous quote, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." And then Orlando writes, "The maxim is more true for Russia than for any other country in the world." So, Orlando, is that true? Why is that the case?
I believe it is true, not just because Orwell probably had the Soviet Union in mind and the eradication of...
Actually, you might want to mic up a bit, that's it. Close to your... Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Not just because Orwell probably had the Soviet Union in mind, but because the use of history has always been the arena for political discourse in Russia, in modern Russia, for sure. One could argue it goes all the way back to the foundation of Rus. The chronicles we have were also mythological interpretations of a sort of history drawn in biblical time scales rather than in any sort of documentary time scale. And that is at the core of the book. The book was essentially my attempt to sort of draw a point at the end of my academic career. It was, like yours, a lockdown book. And I think I'd come to the conclusion that after 35 years of teaching Russian history, we might have been better off all that time teaching Russian historiography than Russian history. Because my sense was increasingly from about 2012, and looking at the way Putin was talking about Russian history and particularly about Ukraine in his sort of imperial vision of Russia's history, that there was this growing disconnect between the way we in the West might see Russia and but that has its problems in, you know, judging Russia by how far it measures up to our standards and all of that. But all of the sort of major issues of Russian historiography were still being seen by the post-Soviet generation of historians and the propagandization of history through the prism of Russian imperial historiography. What Putin writes today, what he wrote in that infamous essay, is not unusual. It's what you might have found in the history books of the 19th century, Karamzin, Solovyov, even Khrushchevsky. And the problem is that historiography was simply revived after 1991. So whereas Western historiography of Russia had moved on and developed in all sorts of directions, The Russians were still in this imperial discourse about their past, which in Putin's hands, you know, using history for his ideological and eventually military purposes, we needed to understand where they were coming from. And that was my immediate sort of motive in writing the book, that we needed to unpack how they saw their history in order to deal with the Russians. And you know, not to support their views of history, but to deal with the issues that use of history was going to lead Russia under Putin.
And I mean, you write. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, this is a brilliant and ambitious and sort of wide ranging book. But you sort of write that essentially with Russia, these sort of, you call them transcendental myths, these ideas, ideology, are almost as important, or perhaps even more important than the personalities, than the events of what we traditionally consider to be history. I mean, why is that the case with Russia?
Well, I mean, if you take the man voted by Russians in 2016 the greatest Russian who ever lived. It wasn't Stalin, although it could have been Stalin, but it came out publicly, at least, as Alexander Nevsky. We know nothing about Nevsky.
Do us 10 seconds on Nevsky for those who don't know.
Alexander Nevsky was this 13th century prince who supposedly in the battle of defeated the Teutonic Knights wanting to invade Russia, but also convert the Russians to Catholicism. They were part of the Crusades. And Alexander Nevsky rallied the Russians and defeated them on the lake, and Nevsky made this film in which, you know, the Teutonic Knights all go under the ice.
Eisenstein makes
this film. They all go, who did I say?
Nevsky.
Yeah. Sorry, Eisenstein made this. So the understanding of Nevsky is that he, like these other figures in Russian history, Stalin and Putin come to mind, Russia needs a strong man to rally Russia, to defend Russia and the character of Russian civilization, its Christianity, against the foreign invader from the more powerful West. But we know nothing about Nevsky. And in fact, what people know about him is entirely through the film, which in the Second World War was watched by tens of millions of people, which is then fed into the national consciousness, the collective memory of what it is to be Russia, i.e. this victim state always attacked by the West, and why they need the strong state, the strong leader to defend themselves.
I mean, one thing that comes out very clearly from this book is that Russia is not the West, that its politics, its governing system springs from a very different tradition, and you write about both the Byzantine legacy and the Mongol legacy, which a lot of people don't necessarily understand. I mean, tell us about that. Basically, the Mongols in the 13th century conquered what we consider to be modern day Russia, and it inflected its political system thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I tried to do in the book is trace two strands going right through Russian history. The first from Byzantium, when the Grand Prince Volodymyr, as the Ukrainians would call him, or Vladimir, as the Russians did, converted his people to Christianity in 988. He took them into the Byzantine world. And that brought with it a concept of power that was divine, but also godly, in the sense that the symphony of power between church and state was absolutely integrated. And when Ivan IV, the Terrible as we know him, reconquered the lands occupied by the Mongols, he built on that. He invented a genealogy stretching back to the Roman emperors, and supposedly the cap of Monomach, which was the hat worn by the Tsars right through until the 19th century, was a gift from one of the Byzantine emperors. In fact, it probably came from Central Asia. But a mythology of Russia's descendants from Byzantium was developed, which had a long-term effect of sacralizing power. The prince who fell for the defense of Holy Rus'. And then shortly after that, the patriarch, Makari, who crowned Ivan for the first time as a Tsar, the first time a grand prince had been crowned as a Tsar, just a Caesar, to carry on that tradition of Rome, came up with this ideology of legitimization for the Russian state, that Moscow was the third Rome, that after the fall of Constantinople in 1453, and the Council of Florence, when the Greek Church had moved closer to the papacy, Moscow wanted for its church a greater autonomy, broke away, and from that came this myth that Russia was the sole remaining seat of orthodoxy, of true Christianity. And it's from there that this idea of Russia as a special spiritual sphere. Christ is going to return to Russia. He's not going to return to anywhere else. He's going to return to Holy Rus'. And therefore, Russia is a messianic concept. It's a new Israel, if you like. And its purpose is to defend the Orthodox and save the rest of humanity, which feeds into all sorts of political trends in Russian statecraft and foreign policy we might think about. So the sacralization of power was extremely important, and Ivan and then later Tsars could use that to punish any political dissent as heresy, in effect. But in the meantime, Russia had been occupied for almost 250 years by the Mongols. And from that, another tradition came through into the Russian mix of patrimonialism, I would say. The Mongol state built on earlier forms of patrimonialism in Kievan Rus, or Rus as it's probably more accurately called. But it developed a sort of command tribute system, which the Khans used to collect taxes off the Russians, and through the principalities, Moscow the most important as a tax-collecting principality under Mongol rule. But the result of this, as it then developed as a legacy in the 16th and 17th century, was that the Tsars from Ivan onwards took on many of those elements of the emperor or the Mongol Khan, in which essentially he was seen as the owner of the land. In fact, in 1897, in the first Russian census, Nicholas II, asked to put down his profession, described himself as owner of the Russian land. And so the concept of Russia was essentially that it was the very word for power in Russia comes from vlast, the word vlast, which comes from the word volost, which is actually effectively a territorial area which you can feed off. That you own that land and its people. And I think that comes from the problem of land and people in Russia going back to a long time ago. But the effect of that was to that's a huge contrast with the European tradition, where the concept of power comes from potenza, pouvoir. It comes from the idea of Macht in German. It comes from the idea of autonomous action. The freedom of action gives you power. In Russia, power comes from your fiefdom. It comes from what you own, the land and the people. And that, I'm afraid, has continued right through until the present day. I mean, in a sense, Putin's relationship with the oligarchs now is very patrimonial. You know, you may give land as a tsar to your servitors, but boy, you can take it away from them. They don't own it. Under pre-Mongol Russia, in the Kievan period, if you were a military servitor, you attained land in perpetuity. You could pass it down through the generations. Once tsarism is imposed in this poisonous compound of the sacralization of power and the power being invested in the person, the gasudar, the sovereign is the state, the gasudarstva, then the gasudar, the boss, as you would call him under Stalin, can take away whatever is given to the servitors. They have no rights of property, which of course then explains all sorts of things. It explains why you don't have an independent land-owning aristocracy as a counterbalance to the state. And it explains probably the failure of Russia to develop in this Western pattern of the separation of the monarch from the concept of the state.
That's completely fascinating, and it goes a long way to explaining how we ended up where we are at the moment. I mean, we'll talk about that a bit later on. But there's another kind of outstanding personality who's been in the news recently I wanted to ask Seabag about, which is Potemkin, or Potemkin, Catherine the Great's friend and lover, whose bones were recently taken from a cathedral crypt in the city of Kherson, where I was recently in November. It's just been taken back by the Ukrainians from Russian occupation, and were spirited across the Dnieper River. We don't quite know where they are now, but perhaps you might explain, Seabag, why Potemkin's bones are so important to the contemporary Kremlin.
I agree with Orlando's tour de force on the creation of the state. And I just want to add one thing. I mean, the interesting about Alexander Nevsky, for example, is the only thing we do know about him is that he was basically a Mongol henchman, you know, who was serving the Mongol Khans. And but you know, the Potemkin, the interesting thing about Potemkin, I think, for what's happening today in Russia and Ukraine, is that, you know, the southern Ukraine has really only been Russian since the 18th century, exactly the same time as the creation of America. You know, these people were contemporaries with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and they were creatures of the Enlightenment, but they were also great imperialists, and you know, their dream was a Greek project to expand Russia, not just into South Ukraine, but to take Istanbul and Constantinople as well, Tsargrad, as they called it, and they succeeded certainly in taking southern Ukraine and Crimea, and then those regions were ruled by the Khanate of the Crimeans and the Ottomans, and they were Muslim areas. And their project, starting in about 1768, was to retake these areas. Potemkin's achievement was to deliver them to Catherine the Great, and then to colonize them and to build the cities that we read about all the time now. In the news, Mariupol, Odessa, Kherson, Katerinoslav, that's now Dnipro, and all these, Mykolaiv as it was then, all these places were colonized, settled with Russians, with Ukrainians, with Jews, with Italians, with Greeks. Mariupol was basically a Greek city. And that's why in Putin's speeches, in his famous essay, and in his many speeches, he's constantly harking on about Suvorov, who was a general fighting for Catherine the Great under Potemkin, and Ushakov, the admiral. And this is really the real foundation story of the Russian connection to southern Ukraine. The one with St. Vladimir, we know virtually nothing about, is sort of medieval prehistory almost. But this is the real story, and that's why he's constantly mentioned in Putin's speeches and his articles, and that's why 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago they stole his body, and I believe that they will kind of somehow memorialize Potemkin in Moscow, build a sort of tomb, almost like a Lenin's tomb for him, with the names of these cities and when they were taken.
Orlando, on you mentioned Putin's essay, and obviously you've had a very distinguished academic career at Birkbeck and Cambridge. You've marked a lot of essays in your time. I mean, essentially, he argues that Ukraine was never a thing, and that Russia, Belarus, Ukraine all flow from this sort of single spiritual, cultural space. I mean, if this essay had crossed your desk as a professor, how would you have graded it, the Putin essay?
Well, it's a tricky one. I mean, because factually there's actually not much wrong with it. It's the interpretation and the Orwellian political structure that he imposes on the history that's the problem. And at the heart of this concept that Ukraine has never really existed properly as a state, it has no statehood, has no nationhood, other than the one given to it by Lenin. I mean, okay, that is essentially grafting on to his interpretation of history, a concept that he's probably taken from Carl Schmitt. Now, Carl Schmitt was this Nazi ideologist, legal theorist, whose ideas have come into Russia, they come into other authoritarian regimes, and the one that's been most instrumental is this idea of hegemonic states, that there are civilizations which can have only one statehood, and the Slav statehood has to be based in Moscow. It has to be a Russian statehood, and everything else is just a region of that. And that's essentially the idea driving that essay. But obviously there are other things in it one could question. Obviously there's, I mean, the whole treatment of Lenin and Stalin. I mean, he skirts over the attempts by Ukrainian nationalists and Democrats in 1917, 18 and 19 to establish a statehood. That's completely sort of skirted over in favor of an interpretation of Ukraine as an anti-Russia created by hostile Western powers wanting to use it as a Trojan horse against Russia, which he rehearses through history, going back to the Poles and the Swedes in the 17th century. So that's a very odd interpretation of the foundation of a Ukrainian state in 1917, although it didn't last long, and again in 1919, again didn't last long.
Four, 5 out of 10?
Is that a B plus?
B plus?
B plus?
Yeah, something like 4 out of 10.
C-bag? Just very briefly?
Yeah. I think a C minus.
C minus. Okay. Well,
after all, I think the interesting thing is here, like, it's a very strange argument that comes from a very strange ideological genealogy, as it were, because actually most of the states we regard as completely legitimate in the world today didn't exist 100 years ago. I mean, virtually all of them. Indonesia didn't exist in the way it does today. India didn't exist. I mean, Pakistan. I mean, you can mention virtually every state except the old European empires. Yeah. No other states existed.
And the essay is irrelevant, really, to what's going on now. I mean, what all of this ancient history has to do with the post-1991 situation is, you know, it's so remote to be completely irrelevant, but is a good illustration of the Orwellian maxim. This is, I mean, when the essay appeared, it reinforced my sense that this book had to be about the ideas driving it, because to anyone who knows their history, that essay was virtually a declaration of war on Ukraine, because it was saying Ukraine has no right to exist. It has no statehood in its DNA.
I would completely agree with that. And what one thing that struck me, and Orlando, I wonder what you make of this, is that it's written by a former KGB officer who spent his career, the early part of his career, you know, mouthing Soviet platitudes about Marxism-Leninism. But actually, the ideas that he transmits are classic early 19th century ideas of orthodoxy, nationality. They're sort of Nicholas I ideas, sort of neo-imperialism. I mean, why is a KGB officer channeling sort of 19th century imperialism?
I think that cohort of KGB men, Siloviki, who came out of the catastrophe as they see it of 1991, they blamed Bolshevism to a large degree for the disintegration of the Soviet Union. They blamed their immediate seniors. I think they felt that they had been let down by these older guys who'd lost an empire. I mean, Mikhail Gorbachev first and foremost. And they wanted to put the clock back. They wanted to take revenge on Ukraine above all, because in 1991 it was the Ukrainian Declaration of Independence that had really pulled the plug on the Soviet Union. They couldn't go back to any sort of democratic discourse, because that again was seen by these type of hard men as again just a sort of Western imposition on Russia. So the only place that they felt ideologically they could go was back to the whites, was back to the Eurasianist emigre ideologists of the 1920s and 30s, who, in the name of restoring Great Russia, adopted fascist ideas, ideas like those propounded by Carl Schmitt, that you could work with Bolshevism only insofar as it was going to restore a great Russia.
In which case, just explain one thing to me. I mean, you know, traveling around Ukraine, going to areas which have been occupied by Russia, deoccupied, and some of the areas still occupied, one of the things that the invading Russian troops have done have put Vladimir Lenin back on his pedestal quite a long time after he was toppled. So if it's all about whites and emigres and so on, why is Lenin making something of a comeback?
Well, Lenin's only a symbol of the Soviet Union. I mean, it's the Soviet Union they're trying to reimpose on Ukraine. And there has been, there was, after 2014 especially, a war of symbols. So, you know, when Putin wrote that essay and in other articles and speeches focused on the Nazi element in Ukraine, etc., it was because, from his point of view, it was because the Ukrainians were putting up statues to Stepan Bandera or Petliura. These were, in the Russian Soviet historiographical view, these were nationalists of a anti-Russian but also Nazi sort of persuasion.
If I can just interject, but also it's to do with the special role of World War II in the Soviet Union. I mean, just as in the 19th century, all Russian leaders, all Russian thinkers look back to 1814 when they took Paris. So in the 20th century, the taking of Berlin in 1945 was an absolutely seminal and real event that had actually, rather than all these transcendental myths that actually were all made up, they had actually taken Berlin. And that's why Stalin has a different role. Even though Stalin and Lenin together created Ukraine and together created the structure of the Soviet Union, which Putin and his people so blame for the creation of a Ukraine that then became independent in 91, Stalin has a different role, because Stalin became a sort of national Russian figure as well in the taking of Berlin, in the victory in World War II, which is why Stalin has a special role and Lenin takes all the blame.
Well, Lenin takes the blame because he wanted a Soviet Union, and in formal terms got a Soviet Union in which the right of secession would exist, albeit only on paper. On paper.
Yeah.
Whereas Stalin had been trying to push through what he called the autonomization plan, in which they wouldn't have a right to secede because they would be merely autonomous regions within Russia. So that's why Stalin is okay, but also because Stalin, as Seebeck says, won the war, but also because he built an empire. He effectively, from that moment in 45, merged the Soviet identity with the great Russian identity. So that is why Putin will look back to Stalin as an ideological groundwork for his claim that actually Russia is the successor state to not just everything that the Soviet Union had in terms of the infrastructure, the seat on the UN and all the rest of it, but it inherits Russia's the Soviet imperial identity. So that enables, and that's deep in the national consciousness of the Russians. This very complicated Soviet identity was merged increasingly with the great Russian identity to become one, almost, which is, I think, why so many Russians are actually quite sympathetic to the war being pursued by Putin, because they see the Ukrainians as little brothers of this bigger Soviet entity, which they might not have thought of at the time as being an empire, although de facto, obviously, it was an imperial relationship, but which they associate with part of their Russian identity, which is shared with Ukrainians, and part of the Soviet Union, which they feel nostalgic about.
I'm going to get some questions in a minute. There's one more question I want to ask, which is that both of you have a long and illustrious association with Russia. You both started going around about 1984, 1985. Orlando, I'm starting with you. You wrote a kind of wonderful piece for the Financial Times in London recently, recalling your student days, burrowing in the archives in Moscow, and in eating borscht, I think you said, with an insect in it, or maybe it was just greasy, I can't remember. Take us back to those days and tell us where your interest in this subject, in this country, came from.
Oh, came from purely accidental. When I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, I was more interested in doing something about the young Hegelians and German-Jewish intellectual history of the 1830s and 40s. And my teacher at that time, Norman Stone, a Glaswegian, said to me, Orlando, if you got a hangover, or you've got problems with your girlfriend, you don't want to battle with Hegel every day, why don't you do something empirical, like Russian peasants? And I thought, okay, fine, I like Russian literature. I got a scholarship to learn Russian, and went off into the archives to study the Russian peasants of the Volga region during the Civil War. Now, my actual project was to try and study some of the peasant rebellions against the Bolsheviks at the end of the Civil War, but you couldn't declare that, because working in the archive of the October Revolution, as it was in 1984, we were in a separate room manned by the KGB, and you had to give in your requests for documents, but we didn't have access to the catalogue. So how did you know what to order? You could only do it by working from other published Soviet historians' footnotes. But there was a way around it, because although we were separated from the Russians, and the Soviet researchers not allowed to use even the canteen, they couldn't stop us using the same toilet. And the toilet was the place where the Soviets went to smoke, and I smoked in those days, and I found one or two nice archivists who would give me the numbers I needed. And then they weren't questioned, because if I had them, they must have come from some authorized Soviet historian. But gradually, as I was there in the later 80s, the archives opened up, and it became possible. I think I was the first historian to get a catalogue for the revolutionary period. And the party archives then opened up, and we had this bonanza, which we've all benefited from. But which sadly now is really threatened.
Seebeck?
Well, I mean, I first went there with my father, I think 1984, to visit Jewish refuseniks, which was a wonderful expedition at a time when we thought the Soviet Union would last forever. And it never occurred to us that it would fall, that it was about to fall. Gorbachev was about to come to power. Chernyenko was about to die. But then I went back. I studied. I mean, I was very lucky because my real patroness was Isabel de Madriaga, famous, who was very like Empress Catherine herself. And it was she who said to me, you should write a biography of Potemkin. No one's done a biography of Potemkin. And she thought of herself as Catherine the Great. And she was a bit in love with Prince Potemkin.
Was she in love with you?
I was going to say, yeah. So you stole my question. Was she in love with you? Yeah.
But she did ask me to put flowers on his grave when I went. But when I started working in the archives, like Orlando's extraordinary experience, I mean, no one really studied Catherine the Great during the Soviet period, because she was regarded as much too feminine, much too aristocratic, much too debauched, much too libertine for the Soviet Union. All things we love, of course. And so there was virtually no one in there, and the archivists themselves, who were all intermarried and quite a strange group of people. This was in Peter II's old palace. And I remember that the first day I was there, the archivists were very determined not to give me any Potemkin and Catherine stuff that showed any love, amorous relationship between them, because a Westerner could not be trusted with this sort of information. So when I finally got some documents and I sat down in the reading room and started looking at this stuff, there was a screaming noise and a cat landed on my head. And I looked up to the gallery and one of the archivists, a rather sort of terrifying looking woman, had dropped a kitten on my head from the thing, and she was just reminding me who was in charge. So that was a pretty formative experience in working in the Russian archives.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jeopardites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Lonchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.